Chapter 9. The In Mind of the Color of Objects in Dreams, a strange, hazy, lurid hue. How noble are some of his landscapes! What a depth of solemn shadow is in yonder wood, near which, by the side of a black water, halts Diogenes. The air is thunder-laden, and breathes heavily. You hear ominous whispers in the vast forest gloom. Near it is a landscape, by Carol du Jardin, I believe, conceived in quite a different mood, but exquisitely poetical too. A horseman is riding up a hill, and giving money to a blousy beggar wench. Oh, Matchetan, I roars, or Excaliburs! In what a wonderful way has the artist managed to create you out of a few bladders of paint and pots of varnish. You can see the matutinal dews twinkling in the grass, and feel the fresh, salubrious airs, the breath of nature blowing free, as the corn lawman sings, blowing free over the heath. Silvery vapors are rising up from the blue lowlands. You can tell the hour of the morning, and the time of the year. You can do anything but describe it in words. As with regard to the person above mentioned, one can never pass it without bearing away a certain pleasing, dreamy feeling of awe and musing. The other landscape inspires the spectator infallibly with the most delightful briskness and cheerfulness of spirit. Herein lies the vast privilege of the landscape painter. He does not address you with one fixed particular subject or expression, but with a thousand never contemplated by himself, and which only arise out of occasion. You may always be looking at a natural landscape, as at a fine pictorial imitation of one. It seems eternally producing new thoughts in your bosom, as it does fresh beauties from its own. I cannot fancy more delightful, cheerful, silent companions for a man than half a dozen landscapes hung round his study. Portraits, on the contrary, and large pieces of figures, have a painful, fixed, staring look, which must jar upon the mind in many of its moods. Fancy living in a room with David Sands' Culet Leonida staring perpetually in your face. There is a little Watteau here, and a rare piece of fantastical brightness, and gaiety it is. What a delightful affectation about yonder ladies flirting their fans, and trailing about in their long brocades. What splendid dandies are those, ever smirking, turning out their toes, with broad blue ribbons, to tie up their crooks and their pigtails, and wonderful gorgeous crimson satin breeches. Yonder, in the midst of a golden atmosphere, rises a bevy of little round cupids, bubbling up in clusters, as out of a champagne bottle, and melting away in air. There is, to be sure, a hidden analogy between liquors and pictures. The eye is deliciously tickled by these frisky Watteaus, and yields itself up to a light, smiling, gentleman-like intoxication. Thus, were we inclined to pursue further this mighty subject, yonder landscape of Claude, calm, fresh, delicate, yet full of flavor, should be likened to a bottle of Chateau Margaux. And what is the Poussin before spoken of but Romani Gili? Heavy, sluggish, the luscious odor almost sickens you, a sultry sort of drink, your limbs sink under it, you feel as if you had been drinking hot blood. An ordinary man would be whirled away in a fever, or would hobble off this mortal stage in a premature gout fit, if he too early, or too often indulged in such tremendous drink. I think in my heart I am fonder of pretty third-rate pictures than of your great thundering first-rates. Confess how many times you have read Beringer, and how many Milton. If you go to the Tar and Garter, don't you grow sick of that vast, luscious landscape, and long for the sight of a couple of cows, or a donkey, and a few yards of common. Donkeys, my dear McGilp, since we have come to this subject, say not so, Richmond Hill for them. Milton they never grow tired of, and are as familiar with Raffle as Bottom with exquisite Titania. Let us thank heaven, my dear sir, for according to us the power to taste and appreciate the pleasures of mediocrity. I have never heard that we were great geniuses. Earthy are we, and of the earth. Glimpses of the sublime are but rare to us. Leave we them to great geniuses, and to the donkeys. And if at nothing profit us Arius tentistomos along with them, let us thankfully remain below, being merry and humble. I have now only to mention the charming Rush Cassie of Cruz, which all the young ladies delight to copy, and of which the color a thought to blue, perhaps, is marvelously graceful and delicate. There are three more pictures by the artist, containing exquisite female heads and color, but they have charms for French critics which are difficult to be discovered by English eyes, and the pictures seem weak to me. A very fine picture by Bon Balling, Saint Benedict resuscitating a child, deserves particular attention, and is superb in vigor and richness of color. You must look, too, at the large, noble, melancholy landscapes of Philippe de Champagne, and the two magnificent Italian pictures of Leopold Robert. They are, perhaps, the very finest pictures that the French school has produced, as deep as Poussin, of a better color, and of a wonderful minuteness and veracity in the representation of objects. Every one of Lesueur's church pictures is worth examining and admiring. They are full of Dion and pious mystical grace. Saint Scholastica is divine, and the aching down from the cross as noble a composition as ever was seen. I care not by whom the other may be. There is more beauty, and less affectation, about this picture than you will find in the performances of many Italian masters, with high-sounding names. Out with it, and say raffle at once, I hate those simpering Madonnas. I declare that the jardiniere is a puking, smirking miss, with nothing heavenly about her. I vow that the Aunt Elizabeth is a bad picture, a bad composition, badly drawn, badly colored, in a bad imitation of Titian, a piece of vile affectation. I say, that when Raphael painted this picture 2 years before his death, the spirit of painting had gone from out of him. He was no longer inspired. It was time that he should die. There, the murder is out. My paper is filled to the brim, and there is no time to speak of Lesueur's crucifixion, which is odiously colored, to be sure, but earnest, tender, simple, holy. But such things are most difficult to translate into words. One lays down the pen, and thinks and thinks. The figures appear, and take their places one by one, ranging themselves according to order, in light or in gloom. The colors are reflected duly in the little camera obscura of the brain, and the whole picture lies there complete. But can you describe it? No, not if pens were fish brushes, and words were bladders of paint. With which, for the present, adieu. Your faithful M.A. T. to Mr. Robert McGilp, Newman Street, London. The Painter's Bargain. Simon Gambouge was the son of Solomon Gambouge, and as all the world knows, both father and son were astonishingly clever fellows at their profession. Solomon painted landscapes, which nobody bought, and Simon took a higher line, and painted portraits to admiration, only nobody came to sit to him. As he was not gaining £5 a year by his profession, and had arrived at the age of 20, at least, Simon determined to better himself by taking a wife, a plan which a number of other wise men adopt, in similar years and circumstances. So Simon prevailed upon a butcher's daughter, to whom he owed considerably for cutlets, to quit the meat shop and follow him. Griskinissa, such was the fair creature's name, as lovely a bit of mutton, her father said, as ever a man would wish to stick a knife into. As he had sat to the painter for all sorts of characters, and the curious who possess any of Gambouge's pictures will see her as Venus, Minerva, Madonna, and in numberless other characters. Portrait of a Lady Griskinissa, sleeping nymph Griskinissa, without a rag of clothes, lying in a forest, maternal solicitude Griskinissa again, with young Master Gambouge, who was by this time the offspring of their affections. The lady brought the painter a handsome little fortune of a couple of £100, and as long as this sum lasted no woman could be more lovely or loving. But want began speedily to attack their little household. Baker's bills were unpaid, rent was due, and the reckless landlord gave no quarter, and, To crown the whole, her father, a natural butcher, suddenly stopped the supplies of mutton chops, and swore that his daughter, and the dauber, her husband, should have no more of his wares. At first they embraced tenderly, and, kissing and crying over their little infant, vowed to heaven that they would do without. But in the course of the evening Christianissa grew peckish, and poor Simon pawned his best coat. When this habit of pawning is discovered, it appears to the poor a kind of El Dorado. Gambouge and his wife were so delighted, that they, in the course of a month, made away with her gold chain, her great warming pan, his best crimson plush inexpressibles, two wigs, a wash hand basin and ewer, fire irons, window curtains, crockery, and armchairs. Christianissa said, smiling, that as he had found a second father in her uncle, a base pun, which showed that her mind was corrupted, and that she was no longer the tender, simple Christianissa of other days. I am sorry to say that as he had taken to drinking, she swallowed the warming pan in the course of 3 days, and fuddled herself one whole evening with the crimson plush breeches. Drinking is the devil the father, that is to say, of all vices. Christianissa's face and her mind grew ugly together. Her good humor changed to bilious, bitter discontent. Her pretty fond epithets, to foul abuse and swearing. Her tender blue eyes grew watery and blear, and the peach color on her cheeks fled from its old habitation, and crowded up into her nose, where, with a number of pimples, it stuck fast. Add to this a dirty, draggle-tailed chintz, long, matted hair, wandering into her eyes, and over her lean shoulders, which were once so snowy, and you have the picture of drunkenness and Mrs. Simon Gambouge. Poor Simon, who had been a gay, lively fellow enough in the days of his better fortune, was completely cast down by his present ill luck, and cowed by the ferocity of his wife. From morning till night the neighbors could hear this woman's tongue, and understand her doings. Bellows went skimming across the room, chairs were flumped down on the floor, and poor Gambouge's oil and varnish pots went clattering through the windows, or down the stairs. The baby roared all day, and Simon sat pale and idle in a corner, taking a small sup at the brandy bottle, when Mrs. Gambouge was out of the way. One day, as he sat disconsolately at his easel, furbishing up a picture of his wife, in the character of peace, which he had commenced a year before, he was more than ordinarily desperate, and cursed and swore in the most pathetic manner. "Miserable fate of genius!" cried he, "was I, a man of such commanding talents, born for this? To be bullied by a fiend of a wife, to have my masterpieces neglected by the world, or sold only for a few pieces. Cursed be the love which has misled me, cursed be the art which is unworthy of me. Let me dig or steal, let me sell myself as a soldier, or sell myself to the devil, I should not be more wretched than I am now." "Quite the contrary," cried a small cheery voice. "What?" exclaimed Gambouge, trembling and surprised. "Who's there? Where are you? Who are you?" "You were just speaking of me," said the voice. Gambouge held, in his left hand, his palette, in his right, a bladder of crimson lake, which he was about to squeeze out upon the mahogany. "Here are you?" cried he again. "Squeeze!" exclaimed the little voice. Gambouge picked out the nail from the bladder, and gave a squeeze, when, as sure as I am living, a little imp spurted out from the hole upon the pallet, and began laughing in the most singular and oily manner. When first born he was little bigger than a tadpole, then he grew to be as big as a mouse, then he arrived at the size of a cat, and then he jumped off the pallet, and, turning head over heels, asked the poor painter what he wanted with him. The strange little animal twisted head over heels, and fixed himself at last upon the top of Gambouge's easel, smearing out, with his heels, all the white and vermilion which had just been laid on the allegoric portrait of Mrs. Gambouge. "What!" exclaimed Simon, "is it exactly so? Talk of me, you know, and I am always at hand. Besides, I am not half so black as I am painted, as you will see when you know me a little better. Upon my word, said the painter, it is a very singular surprise which you have given me. To tell truth, I did not even believe in your existence. The little imp put on a theatrical air, and, with one of Mr. McCready's best looks, said, here are more things in heaven and earth, Gambogio, than are dreamed of in your philosophy. Gamboge, being a Frenchman, did not understand the quotation, but felt somehow strangely and singularly interested in the conversation of his new friend. Diabolus continued, colon, you are a man of merit, and want money. You will starve on your merit. You can only get money from me. Come, my friend, how much is it? I ask the easiest interest in the world. Old Mordecai, the usurer, has made you pay twice as heavily before now. Nothing but the signature of a bond, which is a mere ceremony, and the transfer of an article which, in itself, is a supposition, a valueless, windy, uncertain property of yours, called, by some poet of your own, I think, Anonymula, Vagula, Blangulaba. There is no use beating about the bush, I mean a soul. Come, let me have it. You know you will sell it some other way, and not get such good pay for your bargain. And, having made this speech, the devil pulled out from his fob a sheet as big as a double times, only there was a different stamp in the corner. It is useless and tedious to describe law documents. Lawyers only love to read them, and they have as good and shitty as any that are to be found in the devil's own. So nobly have the apprentices emulated the skill of the master. Suffice it to say, that poor Gamboge read over the paper, and signed it. He was to have all he wished for 7 years, and at the end of that time was to become the property of the, provided that, during the course of the 7 years, every single wish which he might form, should be gratified by the other of the contracting parties. Otherwise the deed became null and non-avenue, and Gamboge should be left, go to the, his own way. You will never see me again, said Diabolus, in shaking hands with poor Simon, on whose fingers he left such a mark as is to be seen at this day ever, at least, unless you want me, for everything you ask will be performed in the most quiet and everyday manner. Believe me, it is best and most gentlemanlike, and avoids anything like scandal. But if you set me about anything which is extraordinary, and out of the course of nature, as it were, come I must, you know, and of this, you are the best judge. So saying, Diabolus disappeared. But whether up the chimney, through the keyhole, or by any other aperture or contrivance, nobody knows. Simon Gamboge was left in a fever of delight, as, heaven forgive me, I believe many a worthy man would be, if he were allowed an opportunity, to make a similar bargain. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.